Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, maintaining and operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for nearly 50 years.
There's a lot of planning going on for this upcoming winter about what happens if we have a gas supply issue because we're worried about it.
South Central's largest natural gas utility asks state regulators to reconsider a proposed solution for gas storage. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, July 24th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, tour operators in Kodiak turn to wildlife viewing for a growing number of visitors.
They don't want to go to a zoo and see a Kodiak brown bear. They want to see where the bears live.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska Public Media is now partnering with an Alaskan auction service so a helpful local team can get the biggest return for the least hassle should you decide to donate your vehicle. Learn more at alaskapublic.org/vehicle.
South Central Alaska's largest natural gas utility is asking state regulators to reconsider their decision on a project that would have expanded natural gas storage. That's after the Regulatory Commission of Alaska denied NSTAR's request earlier this month, saying the utility had not provided sufficient information. NSTAR President John Sims says they've been working on the project for more than a year.
This reservoir is almost perfect for what NSTAR views as its short-term and long-term needs.
NSTAR proposed developing and operating a depleted reservoir in Kenai, currently leased and operated by AIX Energy LLC, to store supplies to use during the colder months. In a 31-page petition filed Thursday, NSTAR says the commission's order lacked a true understanding of the problem. The petition says the project is the only viable commercial storage option in Cook Inlet. The utility has to secure more gas storage to continue meeting the needs of its more than 150,000 South Central customers, and the petition says storage becomes critical starting next year. As far as gas supply in general, Sim says he's stressed about this winter.
There's a lot of planning going on for this upcoming winter about what happens if we have a gas supply issue because we're worried about it.
The RCA has 30 days to respond to the petition, and if they don't take any action, it'll be automatically denied. Three Western Alaska tribal governments and several environmental groups have filed new lawsuits seeking to block a controversial road that would cut through Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge. The Alaska Beacon reports the complaints filed in U.S. District Court in Anchorage are seeking to overturn a key federal permit for the project issued earlier this month by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Construction on the road is set to begin in 2 weeks. Attorneys for the Center for Biological Diversity are handling one of the lawsuits filed Thursday by the Native Village of Hooper Bay, the Native Village of Paimute, and the Chivac Native Village. A coalition of conservation organizations represented by Trustees for Alaska, an Anchorage-based environmental law firm, filed a related lawsuit Wednesday. The Corps is named as a defendant in both cases. The tribal lawsuit also names the Alaska Director of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which manages the Eisenbeck Refuge, and Interior Secretary Doug Burgum as defendants. Both cases argue that the permit issued by the Corps is illegal because the federal agency failed to fully consider the impacts to the refuge's wetlands and wildlife. The tribe's lawsuit argues that impacts to migrating geese would have serious consequences for tribal residents who hunt the birds for subsistence. The road would connect the village of King Cove to Cold Bay and its paved 10,000-foot runway, a connection King Cove residents have argued for decades is crucial for emergencies. King Cove's airport has a 3,500-foot gravel runway, making air travel unreliable, particularly in poor weather. A land trade key to the road's construction is also being challenged in federal court by the same plaintiffs, along with defenders of wildlife. A decision in that case is expected soon. Kodiak is not one of Alaska's tourism hotspots, and visitors to the island usually come to hunt or to fish. But interest in wildlife viewing is also growing, and there are a few businesses in town capitalizing on that interest. KMXD's Catherine Irving went on a tour with one of these businesses and has this story.
If you live in Kodiak, it's hard to miss the new business around town. The 10-seater van has a massive photo of four brown bears vinyl wrapped across its body with the words Kodiak Bear Bus written in bold white letters on its side.
We are in our first summer. We are actually a little over a month in.
That's Jacob Buck, the Bear Bus's driver and guide. Today is a slow day. I'm one of two guests on board. Unlike traditional wildlife tours, which start at a specific time, the Bear Bus forms its schedule around the tides. So we're sitting at a bay 30 minutes west of town at 8 p.m. on a Thursday, waiting to see a Kodiak brown bear.
We'll hop out here. Get some binoculars and see if we can see anybody.
The Bear Bus's owners, Scott and Jackie Stone, are not new to the wildlife business. They're based in Kodiak, but spend summers in Katmai National Park, where they host guests for multi-day bear tours. Currently, they're in Katmai and could only answer questions over email. Scott Stone writes that they built the Bear Bus partly to give their Katmai Bear Camp clients something to do while they're in Kodiak. But Buck says another reason was to capture a new market.
They also wanted to help provide a service for the different cruise ships that have been coming into Kodiak.
The Stone's Bear Camps cost nearly $5,000 per person for 3 days. The Bear Bus tours are $130 per person, which Buck says is an easier sell for tourists coming off of a cruise ship. Kodiak is one of Alaska's smallest cruise ship ports by numbers. Cruise companies don't own any of the businesses in town, and most ships bring fewer than 1,000 guests. But according to data from Kodiak's Tourism Bureau, cruise ship passenger numbers are set to go up by 25% this year. Other businesses are capitalizing on the increase in cruise traffic as well. Stephen Foreman owns and operates Kodiak Scenic Tours, a whale watching and sightseeing business. He says the season has been good so far.
It's the best one yet. Each year in the last 5 years has gotten incrementally better. And this one appears to be right in that realm.
Right now, he says cruise ship passengers make up the minority of his business, but that he's been contracting with the ships more than he used to. As for the rest of his customers, he says people normally book with him as an extra after spending their trip on fishing charters. But he says that might be changing.
I was actually really surprised in my tour last night. I actually asked this question to all six of my guests. Hey, are you guys going out fishing? Are you guys going out doing some other like charter stuff? And they were only here to do like wildlife.
He isn't the only one who's noticed this. Sabrina Hicks is the executive director of Discover Kodiak, the city's visitors bureau. As Hicks and I chat in the Discover Kodiak office, a couple wanders in to buy a puffin plushie. They, too, are foregoing fishing charters in favor of looking for puffins and whales. Hicks says it's becoming more common.
That is something that I've seen, and I've been here for 3 years, but just living here for seven, I've seen that change.
Other visitors to the Discover Kodiak office were here for work or to visit relatives, but Mandy and Matt Schaefer were stoked to see Kodiak's wildlife, especially bears.
So just not something we see in Florida, and when you come to Kodiak, there's so many bears, so you want to see bears.
Hicks says she and the Bureau have been developing a plan to get more feedback from the community and make sure Kodiak's tourism scene doesn't get too big. Because at the end of the day, she says the island's down-to-earth feel is what keeps people coming back.
I think that's what the draw is for people to come visit. They have already gone to other communities like Ketchikan and Juneau, but they're searching for more of an authentic experience, and they don't want to go to a zoo and see a Kodiak brown bear. They want to see where the bears live.
But those bears can be tricky to find. Back on the Bear Bus, we have been searching for 30 minutes without any luck. So Buck takes us to see another of the island's large denizens, Stellar Sea Lions. Animals like bears aren't a guarantee, but the sea lions, Buck says, never fail to put on a show. Reporting in Kodiak, I'm Catherine Irving.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Bristol Bay historians mark the anniversary of a transformation for the sockeye fishery.
There were still more sailboats out there than powerboats that first year. But within 2 years, 3 years, the sailboats were totally gone.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Consider a gift of stock to Alaska Public Media. You may avoid paying capital gains tax and receive a deduction. Learn more at alaskapublic.org/stock or contact your financial advisor.
A North Slope Borough police officer fatally shot an Utqiagvik man Wednesday. An Alaska State Trooper dispatch says Borough Police contacted them at around 1 a.m. Thursday asking for help investigating the shooting. In response, the State Department of Public Safety's Bureau of Investigation began looking into it. The dispatch says borough police got a report late Wednesday of a disturbance at a residence in Utqiagvik. When police officers arrived, they saw 25-year-old Cortez Ullman Jr. of Utqiagvik standing in a doorway holding a rifle. Police said he went inside the home and that soon after they saw him pointing a rifle at the officers. In response, troopers say one of the officers then shot Ullman. He was transported to a local hospital where he was pronounced dead. Ullman's body was sent to the state medical examiner's office for autopsy, and troopers say his next of kin have been notified. According to the trooper dispatch, once the Bureau of Investigation completes its investigation, it will be independently reviewed by the Alaska Office of Special Prosecutions. A small cruise ship traveling through southeast Alaska has reported outbreaks of a gastrointestinal illness on two back-to-back voyages this month. On one of the sailings, nearly a third of the passengers got sick. That's according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. In total, there have been four such outbreaks aboard the National Geographic Seabird since late May. The ship was last in Juneau on July 15th. A total of 32 people, including passengers and crew members, were infected. The illnesses on both trips caused people to experience vomiting and abdominal cramps. Diarrhea was an additional symptom in the outbreak that started last week. The CDC has not yet determined the cause. Norovirus caused the Seabird's first and second outbreaks, one in late May and another in late June. The CDC has reported 9 outbreaks in the 2026 cruise season so far. The National Geographic Seabird accounts for 4 of them. The small cruise ship was scheduled to be in Juneau next on Saturday. According to Cruise Line Agencies of Alaska, that sailing has been canceled. The Skagway Police Department has a new drone program. The department says the donation of 2 drones will allow the department to increase its capacity for search and rescue operations. KHNS's Melinda Munson saw firsthand how the small aircraft work.
Sergeant James Michaels from the Skagway Police Department held a demonstration outside the police station last week.
So this thing's going to create pretty good rotor wash. I'm going to put it up at about 10 feet, and if you'd like, you can walk underneath it and feel the amount of force it takes.
The black machine is about 2.5 feet by 2.5 feet. It's 200 feet above our heads and showing clear images of a cruise ship 13 blocks away.
This is a DJI Matrice 210 drone. This one and a one just like it were donated to us by the Valdez Police Department when they upgraded their system.
Michael says the system would have cost the department about $50,000. The machines will serve multiple purposes.
Purpose is search and rescue. We will look for lost hikers. We can travel over the water with it. We use it for crime scene overwatch and to also document crime scenes. Same thing with the fire. We'd be able to fly over fire scenes and take aerial photos.
Michael says the drone was sent out on its first rescue mission a few weeks ago.
It was an individual who got off trail over by Upper Reed Falls and got cliffed out for a little bit, but she ultimately self-rescued. But we did have the drone in the air looking for her.
The drones are also designed to transport emergency equipment. They can hold up to 8 pounds, although Michael says he'd stick closer to 6.
If we were to find somebody, let's say, lost in the woods, and we could take the drone and drop them a portable radio or food or medical supplies.
Michael's and Police Chief Jerry Reddick are both licensed to fly the equipment. They have been flying drones on their own for about 10 years and recently went through a certification program that allows them to fly on behalf of the municipality. Depending on where they're flying, the operator might need to notify the Federal Aviation Administration or the local helicopter strip.
So there is another aircraft in the area here, so we have to be careful.
Okay.
The drones can fly up to about 35 miles per hour. Their batteries last from 20 to 30 minutes. They can't fly in heavy rain or fog. While they're designated for rescue missions and official work, Michaels makes an exception for the demo.
Oh, there's your house.
Wowzies, I gotta cut my lawn.
Michael says the drone doesn't have a name yet, or at least one that's suitable to broadcast on the radio. In Skagway, I'm Melinda Munson.
Earlier this year, the city of Craig shut down their community pool amid safety concerns. The city is diagnosing the issues and evaluating repair options. But as KRBD's Sydney Dauphiné reports, the problems are likely foundational, and it may take years until they can open the facility back up.
The pool at the Craig Recreation and Aquatic Center is a 25-yard, six-lane competition pool. It's the only one like it on Prince of Wales Island. And today, the sides are lined with caution tape to keep people out. It's for safety reasons. The bottom of the pool is busting open. Craig Aquatics Director Mandy Griffin says when the holes started emerging earlier this spring, it was unexpected.
We had patrons in swimming, and we had one of our patrons go, "I think you guys have a hole on the bottom of your pool." And we're like, "Oh my goodness, yes, yes, we do."
Griffin says at the time, the first hole was around the size of a baseball. But by the end of the week, it was about 2 feet wide. More holes started popping up, erupting, and gradually expanding. She points out a couple more visible spots that are likely to burst.
You can see this kind of void that's occurring, and there's another one that's right here in lane two where you can see that dip coming out of it.
Yeah.
And that will eventually do exactly what those did, and it kind of volcanoes off the bottom. Okay. It's neat to watch, but not great for us in theory.
With recommendation from the Department of Environmental Conservation, the city voluntarily made the decision to close the pool for safety reasons. One risk is that if someone were to get their hair or toe caught in one of the holes, the weight of the water could entrap someone. And the quartz plaster coating that's bursting from the bottom is similar to glass. Griffin says even though you can't see them, there are particles everywhere, and it's shedding more and more over time. If that quartz plaster gets into someone's eyes or someone accidentally swallows it, Griffin says there's no telling what the effects of that would be.
It's not a liability or a risk we should be willing to take right now.
The city is still determining exactly how this happened. The city council voted earlier this spring to hire a company to conduct a structural engineering inspection of the site to better understand the scope of the problem. That was completed in early June and found extensive cracking, leaking, and movement beneath the pool structure. The company said deep foundation stabilization efforts will be crucial to any repairs or reconstruction. Last week, the council voted to approve a peer review of that analysis, basically to hire someone to double-check the company's work before moving forward with any big decisions.
Could we have just come in and replastered this? Absolutely. Would it have held? Probably not. We would be looking at, you know, spending a substantial amount of money to replaster for it to happen again in 2, 3, 4, 5 years down the road, if even that. So yeah, it's all about long-term solutions right now.
Any actions must be approved by the city council. There are a few ways to go forward. One option is to install a stainless steel system to the existing pool structure. Griffin estimates that could easily be kept under $4 million. Another option is to demolish the pool and rebuild it from scratch, which she estimates would cost more than $20 million. Some council members, like Michael Kampnich, have expressed that a $20 million price tag is unrealistic.
If we get into having to fund a major renovation of the whole pool, that's not going to happen out of our pocket. That's only going to happen through a federal grant or a state grant. And we're in some really lean times, both at state and federal levels, so I don't see that happening.
Regardless of which method the council decides to move forward with, there's the additional hurdles that come with being in a remote location. Getting materials and labor out to the island can take a lot of time. In the meantime, the recreation staff is making do with what they have. The fitness center, hot tub, sauna, and kiddie pool are still open. A smaller above-ground pool is set up as a stopgap. They're hoping to get a larger above-ground pool donated soon as well. But even with these measures, Griffin says they've lost a lot of use at the pool.
We've got to get this facility back open. Our community depends on it.
The Aquatic Center has had to cancel swim lessons, movie nights, and AquaFit programming. Griffin says she's concerned how the community, and especially the youth, will fare when the rainy season starts. But she's worked with facility reworks and rebuilds before, and she says she's optimistic. Reporting in Craig, I'm Sydney Dauphiné.
There are fewer sockeye salmon in the Kenai River than expected this summer, only a year after last year's record run. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game projected another strong run this year, but so far the stock is well below projections. This week, state sonars are counting about 20,000 Kenai River sockeye per day on average. At this time last year, there were hundreds of thousands per day. And the total run to date was about six times higher. The department says the peak of the sockeye run usually falls in mid to late July. Patrick Fowler coordinates management of Cook Inlet for the state's sport fish division. He says there might still be good fishing ahead.
So the counts coming in through the in-river sonar have been kind of below what we expected this time of year. But we are still expecting a late run timing. So we're hoping to see those counts pick up any time in the next few days, ideally. But we're waiting on bated breath.
Fowler says the department could still meet its escapement goals if the run picks up soon. But if the counts stay low, the department might step in to protect the salmon that do show up. The Kenai River's personal use dipnet fishery is open through the end of the month. Sport sockeye fishing is open in much of the Kenai River. Today, diesel-powered boats fish Bristol Bay's waters by the hundreds, but it wasn't always that way. Motorized fishing vessels were once banned in Bristol Bay, and in their place, sailboats dominated the commercial fishery. This year marks 75 years since the ban on powerboat fishing was lifted. KDLG's Jesse Sheldon reports.
Until the early 50s, most commercially caught salmon in Bristol Bay were harvested from a sailboat.
Powerboat fishing is a lot easier.
That's the late Harvey Samuelson, one of the fishermen who sailed for salmon. This audio is from a 2005 interview that aired on KDLG in a Bristol Bay oral history program called Our Story.
We didn't have no reels or anything like that. It was all manhandling wooden corks. It'd get awful heavy. Now you got plastic floats, corks.
Samuelson said, without a motorized vessel, the job was not easy.
Sailing was a lot of fun, but to make a living in a sailboat was sort of tough.
Tim Troll is the creator of Our Story, who interviewed Samuelson. He's also director of the Bristol Bay Heritage Land Trust and author of the book Sailing for Salmon. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game manages the commercial sockeye fishery now, but it used to be federally managed. And Troll says the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service finally allowed powerboats to fish in 1951.
There were still more sailboats out there than powerboats that first year. But within 2 years, 3 years, the sailboats were totally gone or converted to powerboats themselves.
That makes this year the 75th anniversary for the final year of mandated sailboat fishing in Bristol Bay. Troll and the Bristol Bay Historical Society are honoring this milestone at this year's festival in Naknek by hoisting the sail on a restored Bristol Bay fishing sailboat called the Libby 76. The boat is called a double ender for its similarly cut bow and stern.
One of the best examples of probably the epitome of that sort of 19th century boat building.
The boat made its return to the bay during the record-breaking salmon run of 2022, when it was actually able to dip its net in the water for the first time in decades. Troll and a team restored the Libby 76 in Homer and sailed it back to Bristol Bay to participate in the historic season. To honor this year's 75th anniversary, Troll is releasing a new edition of his book, Sailing for Salmon, which now includes a section on the Libby 76's return journey home.
The goal of getting Libby 76 back to Bristol Bay was to have an example of what it was like to fish in Bristol Bay during the sailboat years. It is, after all, a fishery that was born on the wind.
In the days of Bristol Bay sail fishing, fishermen were cannery employees in processor-issued boats, like the Libby 76. Troll says that sail fishing became obsolete throughout the country in the 1920s, but the continued ban on motors in Bristol Bay was a cannery-supported federal regulation under the guise of conservation.
A lot of it had to do with canneries being able to control their fishermen, worried about having power boats, that would create an independent fishery.
In his 2005 interview, Harvey Samuelson said it also kept costs for canneries low.
Because it's a cheap operation, cheap way to get fish.
Samuelson was one of the fishermen working to lift the ban on powerboats. He said unions were a critical part of this effort, but that collective organization is missing from the bay in the new century.
We had fishermen's union. Something that's lacking today is any kind of fishing organizations. Here in the bay, there's none, absolutely none. It hurts to see that. Here's one of the biggest natural resources on face of the earth, and no organization to take care of it. A fisherman's got absolutely no political clout right today. They can pay them whatever they want.
Larice Egli is the executive director of the Bristol Bay Historical Society, which is partnering with the Bristol Bay Heritage Land Trust to hoist the sails on the Libby 76. She says new maritime technology during World War II, plus a deadly storm in 1948, were the final straws in ending the sail mandate.
Many fishermen perished. And at that point, the labor unions were able to get enough attention from the federal government that the Bureau of Fisheries did start to question the integrity of the conservation claims that the packing companies had been making.
Even though sailboats haven't been hauling in Bristol Bay salmon in many years, Egli says the region's sailing routes, embodied in the Libby 76, have shaped today's fishery.
Somehow this boat just seems to have a history that just continues to find its depth in all of the most interesting historical threads that we can explore here in Bristol Bay.
Egli and Troll say their goal is to develop an ongoing maintenance plan so that the Libby 76 can return to the water, allowing more people to experience Bristol Bay's sailing history firsthand. In Dillingham, I'm Jesse Sheldon.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Ava White in Anchorage, Catherine Irving in Kodiak, Tim Ellis in Delta Junction, Lisa Fu in Juneau, Melinda Munson in Skagway, Sydney Dauphiné in Craig, Jake Dye in Kenai, and Jesse Sheldon in Dillingham. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer tonight is Dave Waldron, Kirsten Dobroth is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Have a great weekend.